Log Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, let's make a deal. Congress strikes a deal to avert fiscal disaster, but apparently no one likes the deal. Congressman Al, Bob, Ralph, John, and myself will discuss the details and ramifications. Who won? Who lost? A recap of the big winners and losers in this endeavor. Could this deal have been done a month ago? Who are the big stalwarts in getting this deal done, and don't necessarily jump on the Tea Party so quick? This and more today on Backroom Politics. It's Tuesday in the city capital, and as always, this is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, a part of our nation's capital, America's premier cigar tavern. This is Backroom Politics, and as they do every Tuesday, joining us is our round table. To my left, he is the former eight-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District, former Vice President of Burlington Northern Railroad for Government Affairs. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
I'm delighted to be back from... No, I'm not. I'd rather be in
St. Croix. Sitting catty-corner to him, he is the former presidential appointee to the Environmental Protection Agency. He is a former member of the staff over at the Environmental Subcommittee in the U.S. Senate. He is John Freshman. John, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you. Big week.
It is a big week. And sitting next to him, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
This is a hell of a week.
So sitting to my right, as he does every Tuesday, he is the director of China programs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the District of Columbia and the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Glad to be here.
We've got several folks here in the peanut gallery, including our friend Frank the Bodyguard, who may chime in time to time. So, what'd you do this weekend? Anything big going on? Oh, that's right. There's a huge debt deal that's on the table that the president just signed into law. That's right. In an amazing, but yet drawn-out, vicious war of compromise, the fiscal crisis has been averted, at least for now. This afternoon, the president signed into law what is now known as Senate Bill 365, or the Budget Reform or the Budget Control Act of 2011, after a 269 to 161 vote in the House last night, with three not voting, and the Senate voted today. And passed it today, sending it to the president's desk, and he voted it in. We now have a fiscal crisis deal. Now then, so many questions, so many things in play on this one. We just might as well get started on this one right now. The big thing right now is, and I'm going to ask this question to start off, and then we'll get into the details of this. Al, could this deal have been done a month ago, the way it was done over the past 48 hours? Did we have to sit through all this drama?
Every compromise could have been done a lot earlier. They just can't be. It's something about human nature. Until you get to the very edge of the precipice, people don't get serious enough to cut deals.
Bob, I want to ask you that same question. You've been around Congress for a long time. Could this deal have been done a month ago?
I agree with Al. I think not only is he right about the idea that it takes the crisis to get you to make a deal, we have such a divided Congress, particularly in the House, that almost anything that one side wanted, the other side didn't want. And it was very, very hard for both sides, both the liberals in the House and the Tea Party right-wingers in the House on the Republican side. It was very hard for them to give up anything. And it was even harder for them to accede to anything the other side wanted. It was just very tough.
But John, I mean, this is a deal that apparently everybody's going on the talking head circuit saying they just don't like. Nobody really likes this deal to begin with, but could cooler heads have prevailed early on?
Well, cooler heads tried. I mean, the noble part about this, which is not, you know, that the president, who's been criticized a lot, and Boehner, who had the most difficult road, they tried to do a bigger, more comprehensive, longer-term deal, and I applaud them for trying to do it. I mean, they tried to do a $4 trillion deal that included closing loopholes, you know, raising revenue, long-term entitlement reform, and it just, they couldn't get it done. And I think that's a failure of the Congress not to have done the big deal. And what we did is we kicked the can down the road. We kicked the spending cuts and maybe the tax to the new super committee. I mean, this didn't really solve anything except for paying the bills.
Ralph, we're seeing a lot of reaction on the financial markets, not necessarily the reaction we were thinking we were going to see, but how's this playing overseas? What are you hearing?
Well, I think people overseas are relieved that America is not being held hostage by its politicians. I think certainly there's a lot of grumbling all the way around about how the U.S. could have allowed this to have come basically to the breaking point before finally coming to a resolution. I think the bottom line is that the Budget Control Act of 2011, it's not perfect, but it is a step in the right direction. It has real spending cuts, tough spending controls, a balanced budget provision, and no tax increases. And the real issue is that in just 7 or so months, the debate in Washington has now changed from how much can we raise taxes to how do we cut spending? How much can
we cut
spending?
Well, let's get into that. We're going to get into that in a little bit deeper detail here shortly, but I want to talk. Let's first talk about how the deal was done.
Okay.
A lot of players were involved in this. It was without a doubt a last minute ditch approach to get this thing through the House on Sunday in time for get it voted on by Monday, get it to the Senate today for a vote and on the President's desk for signature. Literally within minutes of us calling no joy. Bob, who are the big players on the Republican side that you see that really had a hand in this?
I think the two key players were Senator McConnell in the Senate. I think he was
Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the
absolutely.
Senate.
Absolutely. He was absolutely vital to this. And I think the ability of Boehner to get his troops in line finally and overcome a great deal of difficulty were the two key players. And the reason we've only kicked the can down the road, so to speak, and taken care of the deficit and not doing any of the other things we should be doing is because we couldn't get enough agreement, particularly in the House. We couldn't get enough agreement between the two wings of the two parties. The real liberals on the Democratic side and the Tea Party on the right were just not willing to go any farther.
Well, you know, the votes, I mean, the votes that we saw on the Senate side, we were going over that before we went on the air. It was basically 26 senators voted no on this deal. And the names on that list are truly amazing. John, when we looked at the list before on the Democrat side, who stands out as voting no on this in your eyes?
I couldn't find any rhyme nor reason in the Senate for the mixture of people. I think Bernie Sanders voted against it because of the spending cuts, and Jeff Merkley from Oregon. I understood that, but I didn't figure out Bitter from Louisiana or Hatch from Utah, except for maybe that Hatch has a primary. I say it's a real mixed bag. And then you had Chambliss and Coburn, who were the architects of the until Coburn left, the architects of the Gang of Six. It was a little hard to figure out what the connective tissue there was.
And by the way, if you want to call in and join the discussion, ask any questions on this topic or any topic about what's happening here in Washington, please feel free to call in. The number here is 619-638-8477. 619-638-8477. We'll get you right into the smoke-encrusted nerve center of backroom politics here in Washington, D.C. Al, I want to ask you the same question. Anybody stand out as far as no votes on the Senate side in particular? Because it was almost like the Senate seemed to be the method of reason versus the House, which was just totally dysfunctional.
But I was a little surprised with Lautenberg. He seemed to be the Frank Lautenberg
senator out of New Jersey.
And he's certainly very liberal, and liberals had reasons to vote against it, but a lot of other people as liberal or more so than Frank voted for it. So that was surprising.
What about Gillibrand? Does Gillibrand surprise you? Especially being from where she is in upstate New York?
No, because she's been a little on the conservative side for a Democrat anyway. And so I suspect defense or something like that tripped her up.
Interesting. When you look at, I mean, the names that jump out at me, Orrin Hatch is the one that, and Tom Coburn. Tom Coburn, who's been very vocal in trying to get a deal. He was originally part of the Gang of Six, pulled out, went back after a discussion with the president. Why in your mind, Bob, does Tom Coburn vote no on a deal that he was trying to push so adamantly to get done? Was this just political showmanship, or did he have a reason?
I think his reason is that he was so frustrated by the fact that it wasn't a bigger deal. As you probably are aware, he made a proposal recently, he just put it out on his own, about $9 trillion in cuts, and he identifies them very specifically. And I think he was probably just saying, in effect, he knew it was going to pass. So he was, I think, just making a complaint vote, if you will, that we should have done a lot more. And I think most of us around this table would agree it would have been a hell of a lot better if we would have been able to get what the president and Mr. Boehner were talking about, a really big package of deficit reductions and tax expenditures that would have helped us get farther down the road of getting our budget under control. All we do here is we basically have as many cuts as we're increasing the deficit, so we're just treading water.
Essentially, it seems to me that we had the wrong fight in the wrong place. The debt ceiling, it was not the place to have this. And furthermore, we're going to get to the same song's second verse when we start dealing with the budget. And we're going to hear the same arguments and have the same fights all over again. To have it over the debt ceiling was ridiculous.
Well, bringing up the budget is interesting, because right now what we're seeing is, I mean, we should be getting ready to go into conference right now, theoretically, on a 2012 budget, and we don't have it. We haven't seen a viable budget proposal in the House. Nothing's coming out of the White House and with any speed of any sort. It's almost as if we're getting ready for another fiscal year on a continuing resolution. Bob, is that accurate, do you think? Or...
We've been operating under a continuing resolution for 3 years, long before we had the recent elections. We haven't had appropriations completed in 3 or 4 years, and now that's going to happen again beginning September 30th. And not only that, the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year. We haven't gotten out of anything, but I want to echo what Al said just real quick. This is the right fight, the future of entitlements, the future of defense spending, the future, you know, tax reform, all those things. It's the wrong place to have it. It's the wrong hill to fight.
It's interesting. The leadership is framing this as a three-step approach to holding President Obama accountable.
Which leadership?
The Republican leadership, in an effort to sell the Budget Control Act of 2011 to the Tea Party members.
What are those steps?
Cutting government spending more than it increases the debt limit, number one. Number two, implementing spending caps to restrain future spending. And number three, advancing the cause of the balanced budget amendment.
And that's coming out of Republican leadership.
Yes. As a way to sell the Budget Control Act of 2011.
I'll tell you right now, the one thing
I wouldn't buy a used car from them.
No, and the thing that surprised me is...
This is how they have to get the vote.
But the thing that surprised me about that is that they're talking about a way of holding President Obama personally accountable for this. Right. Granted, he's head of state. Granted, he's a chief executive. However, you know, the House, including the Republican leadership, as well as the Senate, have just as much accountability in all this as anybody else.
Well, the issue is the Republicans will say, look, we passed a budget. The Democrats have never put anything on the table.
They haven't passed a budget.
Right.
That's the thing.
But the Republicans keep saying, look, we have passed a budget.
I'll tell you right now, even as a Republican myself, if I see a Republican sitting there talking about how we passed a budget, nobody's going to say that, first of all, because, A, it's wrong, and they'll get called out on it. Second of all, it's total rhetoric. There is no budget in place. Nobody's come up with any sort of proposal viable. The one Democratic proposal, the presidential budget request, was withdrawn by the White House, and the only person who's got any sort of credibility right now on a budget fix is Paul Ryan, in my opinion. Al, you disagree?
No, I don't disagree at all. Paul Ryan put something forward. Now, the trick here is that he had to know it wasn't going anywhere in the Senate. And so it was to demonstrate that the Republicans could, within how they see things, pass a budget to their liking. But whether you... It's a stretch to suggest that this was a budget that they thought was going to become law because the Senate wasn't going to...
No, I think that's true. And I think it's the reality of that question that raises the point that both you and John said, this is the wrong place to have this fight. I think the Republicans felt they had to get this fight now because they weren't able to get anything, they weren't able to get it front and center anyplace else.
All right, let me go back to this.
Yeah.
We've all said now that this is the wrong fight, the wrong place for this fight. It's the right fight, wrong place. What's the right place?
On the budget, you know.
Budget and appropriations.
And appropriations. Where it normally goes up.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about now is... We've got more people coming into the peanut gallery to watch. We're going to actually have a pretty good audience in here today.
Anyone in here?
Wow. But let's. I want to touch on that subject for just a second. When we talk about the debt ceiling and the budget have, in the eyes of many in the U.S. constituency, have become one topic now. They've been blended in together. They've been they've been totally intertwined. They're two separate and totally distinct arguments that need to be had. One is America paying the bills. The other one is the government actually operating. How is it that we've allowed the and I put this back on Congress because it was, and I will throw this back in the Tea Party. It was a Tea Party that made the budget and the debt ceiling a combined issue. How do we separate that out again, John?
I think that this fight, whatever place it was in, is over. And what we're going to have to see now is what are the implications on the economy, which is faltering on its own, of all of these budget cuts. You know, these there are going to be more cuts at the state and local level. There's going to be more jobs lost. We've already seen what's happened at the FAA, and Dow is down. I mean, I don't really quite get how all of this stuff translates into what it's supposed to translate into, which is economic growth.
All right.
Well, the key will be whether the U.S. loses their AAA credit rating. If that happens, you will see the U.S. fall into a tailspin.
Well, we've already seen some of the credit rating houses already come out and say they will not downgrade the U.S. credit rating, that the U.S., as a result of this deal, particularly Moody's and Standard & Poor's, they've said that they will maintain AAA credit rating as a result of this deal today.
But the markets still are not confident.
Which is amazing, and we'll talk about this down the road a little bit, but it's amazing to me because it was the markets that were saying, oh, a deal will get done, a deal will get done, you know, up and down, 20 points, 70 points, etc. The second the deal's done, you know, where's the up?
The markets might have been saying that, but they were moving all their money into cash.
you notice the price of gold is about
almost $2,000,
almost $1,700 an ounce. You know, moving right ahead.
But let's go back to how the deal was done, because you know one of the core subjects that we talk about here on Backroom Politics is the idea of compromise. It's the idea of statesmanship, having legitimate debate without name calling, without sound bites, and getting deals done that best fits to what is in the best interest of the United States. So everybody's claiming, well, this was a big deal and compromise. Al, do you think this was a compromise deal, or was this something that, you know, a lot of people had a lot of cannons pointing at their head?
I think the latter. You can't call it compromise. In fact, and I'm going to say this as a Democrat, and I expect the hoots of derision, but the fact is, because the Tea Party was absolutely unwilling to compromise on taxes, the Democrats swallowed a whole bunch of stuff that they absolutely hated in order to prevent us from defaulting. There was not any give on that. I mean, Bob sat here several weeks ago and said, here's the way you increase revenues without raising taxes. And he talked about closing the loopholes and so forth, as had President Obama subsequently. So that was an effort on the part of the Democrats to compromise. And that was unacceptable. So they finally had to swallow no revenue increases at all and call that a compromise. Well, they had to cave in to save the nation's economy.
John, there's actually some in the Democratic Party that are saying that this was not a compromise deal, that this was the Republicans got everything that they wanted, and the Democrats just kind of just said, all right, whatever, threw their hands up and made the deal anyway. Is that accurate?
Well, no, because they left the issue open of tax reform by the super committee, which is an interesting subject. The super committee is evenly balanced between Democrats and Republicans. So
the dirty dozen, as they're calling it now.
Exactly. They
K Street came up with that.
As long as it doesn't
name.
Become the baker's dozen. Exactly. So I think that there's a lot of stuff still open. It's really not it's a compromise, but it doesn't really mean. Doesn't do much for very long, except for pay our bills through the election. That's really the only thing that it does. And if Al's right, and I agree with him, the Democrats sacrificed in order to enable that to happen.
Well, Bob, we talked earlier about, you know, you had said that this was a kick, you know, just kicking the can down the road. I disagree with you. I think that this staved off fiscal disaster. I think that there is some credible changes that are being made by this with some long-term effects. You still think this is kicking the can down the road?
I think it is kicking the can down the road, but I don't think it's just that. Take, for example, what the Republicans gave on this was the fact that there are going to be some major defense cuts. And for most Republicans, that's a very serious issue.
Well, it also includes Homeland Security cuts, too, which is huge.
Yeah. So the Republicans gave some things, too. Maybe not as much as the Democrats think they gave, but the fact of the matter is, anytime anybody gives something, they always think they're giving more than the other guy.
But talk about kicking the can down the road. I think, can we play Peggy Lee's Manana in our next break? I mean, we're going to deal with all of this tomorrow.
Yeah, we are. But the only thing we did, the only thing this does that is definitive, I think everybody has said it up on Capitol Hill, starting with the vice president. The only thing we've done is we have avoided a default. We haven't solved any of the problems about more revenues. We haven't solved any of the problems about how to fix Social Security or Medicare. We just haven't done any of the things that have to be done. And all those things have to be done within the framework of the Appropriations Committee, the Budgets Committee, and right now, that's the most important thing we have to get done. We're not doing it. That's the problem.
Ralph. I think many members believe that the bill is a step in the right direction because it does reduce the 2012 budget deficit by $17 billion and holds federal spending below 2010 levels until 2016.
Yeah, but the people who are talking about that, the people who are actually making those comments are people that are talking about, you know, a budget reduction on what budget? that's the question I pose back to Capitol Hill.
Current spending.
Right. Okay, we're basically running on borrowed time right now in the current budget situation now.
And they're also talking about the Joint Select Committee creating a plan to achieve another $1.5 trillion in deficit reduction.
Which is greatly reduced from the, you know, we've seen numbers from $9 trillion from Tom Coburn. We've seen $4.5 trillion from House leadership. We've seen, you know, as little as $900 billion on a couple of Democrat side because nobody wants to touch the third rail of defense and non-discretionary spending. They don't want to deal with appropriations or entitlements, rather. They don't want to deal. Those are sacred cows. But I do want to look at, and when we come back into the next segment, because we're about to take a break, when we come back in the next segment, I do want to talk a little bit more about how the deal got done, because there's one player in this that I've been saying should have been the vocal piece or should have been the mouthpiece on this deal for the White House, and that's Vice President Joe Biden. He's actually the one, in my opinion, and according to some news sources, including our friends at Politico, are saying it was Joe Biden that got this deal done. And kudos to him. But we'll talk about that here when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. And we're back live in Shelley's Back Room for Tuesday's interesting discussion on the latest in the fiscal crisis, the resolution, I guess, in some eyes, to the fiscal crisis here in Washington. you were talking, John, you said you had something about
We were talking about the Dirty Dozen and the Super Committee, which I think is one of the most interesting things. If they get a majority, there's no question that we will call them the Magnificent Seven.
By the way, two great movies.
I also want to agree with you, Justin, that the role of Biden cannot be understated. He worked his butt off on this thing, and he stayed out of the press so that he could get things done and forge deals. You're absolutely right about that, Justin.
But people on the left don't give him any credit for that. They're very, very angry about this deal.
Well, they don't like the deal. So you don't want to give any credit to somebody when you don't like the deal.
But here's the thing. Al, you know, as a former Democrat member of Congress, you know, Joe Biden is, without fail, one of the truly great statesmen here in Washington. He's been around the Senate as long as anybody, and he's been noted, especially in his time in the Senate, and even through this process to an extent, as one that could bring a deal to the table, knock out the deal, and just basically bring it home. Why was Joe Biden an ancillary supporter in this whole
situation? Well, I don't think
situation.
He was ancillary. I think it was just said here. He needed to keep a low profile so he didn't become a target and a controversial figure in the whole deal. I have seen it in the past. I remember one year when we had a very difficult thing, and the speaker at that time was Jim Wright, and he sent Tom Foley in. Low profile. He was in there for 3-4 days, and they came out with a deal. Because Foley, like Biden, has a soft touch. He's pleasant. He's very logical and rational, has a good mind for these things, and doesn't tee people off. And Biden has all those qualities, and I think probably playing it when he did and as he did was the right thing to do.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Biden, remember, Biden is not exactly a detail guy. He does have the soft touch. He's got a reputation earned for speaking too much. But in this particular case, for detail, he had Jack Lew by his side. They were a tag team. Lew knew all the details.
The head of OMB.
Yeah, the head of OMB. Sorry, thank you. Biden had the soft touch. But Biden was in and out and in and out. But I think the end game, it was Biden and Mitch McConnell who were the keys to framing the final deal.
Is there a relationship there, Bob? I mean, obviously serving the Senate, it's the secret Senate handshake and the waving of the hand. But is there a true respect between those two?
Well, I think you have to assume that there is because they were able to work together and they pulled it off. And the important thing is when you're talking to somebody else, can you trust them? And McConnell is trustable always, and so is Biden. You can trust them. If they say something quietly, privately to you, you can take it to the bank. That's what was going on. They were behind the scenes. They got the job done.
Well, according to sources that we have, Biden didn't show up to close the deal until 4 o'clock on Sunday, which, in my eyes, I would have loved to have seen him last Sunday. It was Obama that drew the line in the sand with the Republicans saying, look, this is it. We're at point break here. Draws the line in the sand, walks away. In comes Biden, arguably, you know, behind the scenes. I kind of agree with your take on it that he should have been behind the scenes. But Biden comes in, sits down with Mitch McConnell, and says, look, this is how it's got to be.
But because you're focusing correctly on how it got done, I want to add to what Alan said. The person, Jack Lew, is Hillary Clinton. He was working for Hillary Clinton when Obama basically persuaded him to come back over and replace Orszag, who was not a very successful OMB director. Jack Lew is more under the radar than anybody. He's one of the most respected guys in this town. He's exactly like Rob Portman was when he was head of OMB for Bush. He's the same kind of guy. What's interesting to me, and we've talked about this specifically on this show before, is that how much of a role Geithner didn't play.
That's interesting because in the sources that we're getting is that Secretary Geithner is almost playing a lame duck approach in this.
He's getting ready to leave.
But
still,
I think there's an inherent responsibility, even if you are a lame duck secretary, there's still a responsibility of the Secretary of the Treasury to have an active hand in fixing any fiscal crisis that faces this country, especially the paying of the bills.
But Geithner is very controversial. The last thing you needed was to interject somebody who brings his own bad news into a situation that's fraught with bad.
But here's my thought on that, though, is instead of Tim Geithner, because the word was that Tim Geithner was actually over at Treasury Building coming up with possible scenario speeches on a market crash, shouldn't he have been more focused on trying to get this deal done, Al?
No. Geithner doesn't know federal programs. He doesn't begin to know everything across the board.
He was a Federal Reserve chairman of the Bank of New York.
But they know nothing
He's
about
not at all.
They know nothing about the federal spending that's in that $1 trillion worth of spending cuts. He doesn't understand Medicare, Social Security, the kind of stuff where all the money is. He's the tax guy, the international finance guy, and the guy who could credibly say, hopefully, didn't do it that well, about the disaster that would occur if we didn't get this done.
That brings up an interesting question I want to pose to you is does Geithner have the credibility internationally to stave off that type of disaster?
Well, my sources indicated that the Chinese were putting a lot of pressure on the Obama administration to basically bring this to resolution. The Chinese obviously have a lot of interest in our debts, and they want to make sure that they're paid. So Geithner would be dealing directly with the Chinese to stave off their concerns, and would be the PR guy that's going around, as we've seen on the talk shows on Sunday, to sort of allay fears.
John,
the Chinese are interested. Remember that old phrase, if you owe the bank $100, you're in trouble. If you owe the bank $1 million, they're in trouble. You know, China's got a big investment in this country, and they were worried about it right down, and Ralph's right about that.
Bob, you had a comment.
Well, the point is, we're talking about when people got into things. The reason that the jackal was in there, and the reason that Biden was there, because at the end of the day, when you had to get right down to the final cutting, those are the people who had the respect of the people who were going to do the voting. And it was going to take the package back to their respective, you know, caucuses. And they were trusted, and they're well known, and they're believable.
But was in some instances, as the head of OMB, as a direct report to the president, was Lou's hands tied in a certain sense in this deal?
I don't think his hands were tied, and I was intrigued before when you said Obama laid down the line and said this is it. Obama wasn't laying down many lines throughout this whole process. Everything was always kind of flexible within certain parameters that had largely been defined early on, more by the Republicans than by the Democrats. But I don't think Lou doesn't have infinite power to just say, fine, we can agree to $100 billion here or $100 billion there. They go back and talk among themselves in a broader sense in a larger committee because they're speaking one voice. For the White House, the most powerful voice there, everybody else is, you know, you got Senate Republicans and Democrats, you got House Republicans mostly, all of whom are making decisions by committee. But the White House has to be really careful because when Biden speaks or Lou speaks, the assumption is they are speaking for the president. They're cautious and careful.
Right.
In some ways, he's an effective delegator. With putting together a team like Biden that can go around behind the scenes and bring the two sides together.
Well, but the one topic I know that Obama had drawn a line in the sand on was the defense spending issue. As of late Sunday afternoon, went back to the Hill and said, look, defense spending has to be on the table. We're going to have to make some serious cuts in the way that DOD is operating. This is not negotiable.
And that's a great point by you, and I don't think anybody would disagree that the most credible spokesman in the administration is on defense, and he's Bob Gates, and Bob Gates has been willing to entertain defense spending. In fact, he's been leading the charge. And so I think that that played into Obama's agenda. You're right to bring it up.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, the thing that Obama did draw one bright line that he went on that he's not getting credit for, which is this has to go through until the end of 2012. And he got that, despite these conditional things. It's going to take a two-thirds vote in both houses to have to redo the debt ceiling. That ain't going to happen anything.
I think Ralph, one of the criticisms about the military spending was they didn't put a cap on spending for Iraq and Afghanistan. That was one of the issues that the liberal left was very concerned
about.
Well,
this brings up a whole new problem, though, is when this was starting to get down to Point Break, you had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, in theater in Afghanistan. Instead of worrying about, what's our next step, you had a whole base of service members going, hey, boss, are we going to get paid? When the chairman of the Joint Staff the Joint Chief says, I don't have an answer for you. I don't know. That causes a very distinct problem, and that doesn't exactly that's not exactly a morale booster. As a former member of the services, that's not a morale booster for me, knowing, hey, I'm taking a bullet. I may not get a paycheck.
Well, not only that, that was a brief news item, but it's one that I'm sure every single member of the Congress heard.
Yeah. Yes,
and
it was brilliant.
They did not want to be in the position
of
the men who are over there risking their lives for defending American policy, and then finding out that their wives aren't getting checks to feed the children. And it went by so fast.
But it sticks.
But I think that is something that really sticks with about 535 members of Congress.
Let's look, in the last part of the segment, let's look at who the key players were. Were they winners or losers? I want to start with you, Al. Nancy Pelosi, she a winner or a loser in this?
She is a winner in the sense that I think she demonstrated surprising leadership by not getting in and stirring the pot. She loses in that almost everything that she believes in and stands for was put on the line, and she didn't get much for it.
John,
Harry Reid.
Harry Reid, a winner or a loser in this?
I think because he wasn't there at the very end, I think Harry Reid is a little bit diminished. The last deal that was put on the table, he didn't go along with. McConnell stepped in, and at the end of the day, McConnell negotiated the final deal with Biden, not with Reid. I would say that at the end of the day, as much as he did during the process, he was somewhat diminished.
Bob, I go to you. Speaker Boehner.
I think the speaker's a winner, but he was going to be a loser right up until the very end.
How big of a hit do you think he took on this one? Because they had his bill, he couldn't even get it on the floor as of Wednesday and Thursday night.
Exactly.
How big of a hit does he take on this as far as his speakership goes?
I think it's probably too early to tell. At the end, all the the Young Turks, as they call them, led by Cantor, the leadership Turks, they were all with Boehner, and they were all pushing with him real hard.
All right. Next question to you as the Republican at the table, because for the first time, you're outnumbered by Dems.
No. Over here.
Oh, okay.
Alan,
I'll ask you.
That was
I'm bringing all my truth.
Okay, Alan, I'll ask you. The Tea Party, winner or loser in this?
Two things. The simple answer, winner. But the Tea Party is pretty complex, a lot more complex than we gave him credit for. Two-thirds of the freshmen voted with Boehner, one-third said no. That's why Boehner is a winner, hands down. He and his leadership worked with these Tea Party guys. They meet every single solitary week. They brought him along. You look at the quotes from these guys, these Tea Party guys who voted for Boehner. They said, man, we've learned a lot. This is pretty complicated. Experience matters. We are with the speaker. I think it was a huge win for Boehner.
And I agree with that, because what the press is saying, the reason they say he's a loser is that he couldn't get the votes to pass his number.
But he did!
But, well...
Not the first time.
Not the first time.
Not the first day. But, he didn't have a losing vote. He won.
But the point I'm making is that it, the national press, which has a memory that runs up to 30 minutes... 22 minutes. They managed to come down awfully hard on John Boehner when he couldn't, when he had to pull that bill. And that kind of sticks, and I think it was unfair because they've forgotten all the work that he did leading up to that and what he did after.
Round.
I think the key point about the Tea Party is they played by the rules of American politics. They got angry, they got organized, and they got to Washington, D.C. and pushed their agenda. What they are accomplishing is debatable as to whether it's in the best interest of the country in the long run. The interesting point is that of the 60-member Tea Party caucus, 32 members of that caucus supported this budget compromise.
See, I'm going to go out on a limb here and put on my wonk hat for a second. I'm going to say the Tea Party actually is the loser in this. You've got a whole new class of freshman Tea Party members that have come in and basically said, well, you know, we're going to push an agenda, not knowing how Washington operates. This is not a town that you just come in like a bull in a china shop. There's a lot of statesmanship that has to be done. And by the way, having 80-some-odd freshman members of a Tea Party come in and saying, hey, this is how it's going to get done, or we're going to hold this thing at bay, I think that they learned a lesson, but I think that their credibility has diminished a little bit as far as saying their effectiveness in Washington. That rhetoric plays well in the district, but what happens in Washington is a different role. And a lot of these people are people that don't have elected office experience. Al?
And if they don't learn something from this, as we get to these issues in appropriations and what have you, and if they go back to our way or the highway, I think they will be diminished.
Well, they came here, they wanted to change Washington, but the bottom line is in order to get things done, you have to work with both sides. That's what's in the best interest of the American
people. The last person that changed Washington was Ronald Reagan, and he compromised all over the place.
That's right.
Right. Bob.
Alan is correct. That is this. What the Tea Party has learned is that you can fight all you want, but at the end you're going to have to stand where you can get something as much as you can get and take it and be happy. They're learning that. It took them a long time, but they learned something in this fight, and I think that's the reason. I think the person who helped them learn it is the speaker.
I agree with that. However, did it have to take a financial disaster to get that message to them?
That's the old right fight, wrong hill.
All right, there we go.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The most important substrate of our Constitution is the Federalist Papers. Every now and then I go back and I read Federalist 10, and they talk about avoiding the tyranny of the majority. We have divided power. We have checks and balances. The Tea Party can't come in and change everything. They did change the debate to spending, and they get credit for that. But, you know, we're not set up for them to change everything.
All right. Good.
But we have to change the debate from spending to now real reform to promote the best interests of the American people.
Well,
we cannot stop here. We've got to move forward.
Well, again, this is not a subject that's been going away. It's certainly not going away in today's show because we're going to come back. We're going to talk about what exactly is in the deal when we come back here on Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. And we're back live here in Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, live every Tuesday from America's premier cigar tavern. Before the break, we were talking about the budget, the fiscal deal that is in play. Right now, we're going to talk a little bit about what the deal is, because the deal has been completely blown out of proportion. What's in, what's out, what's real. Right now, as it stands, as we know it, what's in the deal? Let's talk about the debt ceiling increase. $2.4 trillion, giving the government borrowing power until 2013. This includes about $400 billion immediately, and the rest is subject to congressional vote in the coming months. Bob, that sounds a little bit like kicking the can down the road. You agree?
It sounds a little bit down. But the fact of the matter is, whether you call it kicking it down the road or getting the deal done, that's what they had to do. And it, as far as I'm concerned, the fact that we didn't default is more important than anything else. I think everybody on Capitol Hill who voted for it, I don't think anybody particularly liked it, but they knew they had to do it. I think if this committee that they're going to be setting up does anything right at all, it'll find ways to go move back toward the concepts that were part of Bowles-Simpson, the big package that the president and Mr. Boehner tried to find. I think those are maybe we have finally got to the point, even among some Tea Party people, to recognize that we have to go farther than just minimum stuff. I mean, the package that we're talking about that we have adopted, we're going to have a bigger debt increase than we're having cuts almost. So we're just getting even. We've got to do something to cut the deficit, and the only way to do that is to find a way to get some more revenues. And I think they can do that if they're willing to go the way some of the bigger packages have been pushed forward.
John, just quickly, it's not $400 billion. It's all the way through the end. It would take a 2/3 vote of both houses to not do the next increment. As far as I'm concerned, it's a long-term deal. I don't think there's any question about that.
This brings up an interesting discussion. It's something that at the last minute they brought up as a possible solution to the debt ceiling, not so much the fiscal issue, was the president had the ability to invoke the 14th Amendment. Is that real, or was that just a red herring? Alan, I'm going to pose that to you.
Yeah, it wasn't a red herring. The president didn't want to go that way. His lawyers all said we think that it would be challenged in court, and we think you'd lose. It is the last ditch thing you do when you really don't have anything else to do. You say, well, rather than default, we will invoke the 14th. We'll be sued. Maybe we lose. We probably lose, but that'll take a while. In the meantime, we've unilaterally done this. We've ticked off a lot of people, but this timing, there was one other piece of the timing that's, I think, useful to remember. August 2nd. Well, a few weeks ago, people started saying, you know, revenues have been a little higher than we expected. We've actually got a little more time. Did anybody talk about that? Uh-uh. Why? Because in this world of Washington, if you can have a deadline that's a real deadline, you work right up to it. A lot of people who've been around a while were not at all surprised that it came to this last weekend. But we were also not surprised that they got it done.
Right.
The last thing they wanted to do was dip 2 weeks more into August and fuzzy up the thing about if there was a true deadline and mess up a whole lot of personal plans.
Well, let's go back to the 14th Amendment question. Al, as a former member of Congress, would that have torqued you a little bit if the president had done that, even though he's the head of your party?
If he did it reluctantly, and he was very reluctant, and if he did it, as Alan suggested, as a desperate last measure that would get us past the deadline and without losing our credit rating, even if it had been overturned by the courts later on.
And that's an argument that would have gone to the Supreme Court. I mean, there's no way that a lower court would have been able to handle that type of interpretation of the Constitution.
Of course, but I think it is very much to the president's credit that he didn't want to do that.
I couldn't agree more. I'm so pleased that we didn't have to do it, because I think it would have been we don't need a constitutional fight on top of everything else.
Right. Ralph.
And I think, looking at it from an international perspective, people were shocked that these guys can't seem to get their act together and that they're going to have to invoke some sort of constitutional amendments to bring this to
Alan, you got a comment to that.
This is the first time that I can remember, however some times, where the rest of the world paid attention.
Yeah.
We oftentimes can't get our act together in the Congress. There's nothing new about that. We bump up against deadlines every year on appropriations bills, kick cans down the road, etc. This was the first time, though, that there were international financial implications and an international audience.
Right.
There's
everything
really
is
new
now,
and unique about
everything
it.
Has now become interconnected.
Okay.
And a lot of these global financial
I have another take on it. I personally think that the president might have been better off if he'd been a little more bullish on the fact that he might use the 14th Amendment in order to move things along and get his way. It was truly a Harry Truman moment. And when Harry Truman had an issue on the steel strike, he said, and the Supreme Court was considering it and they might have overturned him, he says, well, okay, but how big is their army?
Yeah. But going back to, looking at this as a Truman-esque type moment for President Obama, what was not Truman-esque was him taking the reins early on and using the bully pulpit to the best of his ability. Where was the
including the 14th Amendment as part of the bully pulpit?
Exactly. Yeah. Al, do you agree with that? I mean, shouldn't he have done this early on and said, look, you guys can fight it out all you want, but on August 1st, I will invoke the 14th Amendment. If this deal's not done, I am responsible for the fiscal health of this country.
It just doesn't feel it just doesn't feel right to me. Smells of gimmicks. I think the public would have not liked it. He was doing well with the public at that point in time, and that would have been kind of dictatorial, or would have appeared dictatorial.
I would think that to some people on the Hill, that might have been a way out. Let him do it. We're off the hook for the moment. I'd much rather have us stay away from, unusual constitutional activity. I don't think I don't like to go down those roads as a lawyer, as a constitutional lawyer type thing. I just don't like that.
I don't agree with you. I don't agree with Al on this, though. I think that if the president had come out early on and said, look, I've got constitutional authority to do this, I think it would have screamed partisanship, it would have screamed political showmanship. And I agree with Al. I don't think that would have sat well with the American electorate, especially in this time when the general population of the United States, when Congress has a 17% approval rating, and on top of the fact that there's no inherent 100% trust in the government doing what's right for the government as opposed to playing political games. I think Al's right. It would have screamed showmanship. Alan?
This is a president who sort of believes in nuance. And I think if you look back at everything he said in recent weeks, he never said, I will never invoke the 14th. He said, yeah, that's interesting. My lawyers don't think it'll stand up constitutionally. It's an interesting question. But at other times he said, I will do anything and everything that I must to avoid a default. So he was kind of hinting at it. The question is, might he have hinted a little bit more, or did he get the right balance? I think that's really what we're talking about.
All Obama needs to say is, look, the greatest national security interest in our country is our debt. So if I have to invoke the 14th Amendment, I'm going to do that.
Valid point. Let's look at the spending cuts. The deal as it stands right now, signed into law, includes about $1 trillion in spending, or as they're calling it, in savings over the next 10 years from discretionary spending caps. This does not assume the savings that we're going to get in the drawdowns on the two fronts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right, but
John, go ahead. No,
well, the 2012 cap will be $1.4 trillion, which is about $24 billion more than the amount set by the House-adopted budget resolution. I guess you could call that a cut, but it sounds to me like it's not a cut.
Wow. But one of the things that's in that cut that the Democrats won on is there's no immediate touching of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Yeah.
Which
there's very little immediate cut of anything.
That's
what I'm saying. There's no.
It's all down the road. That's this whole question. Did we get the right balance of leaving alone the current spending and backloading all of the cuts? That was the really interesting piece here.
Well, so, you're talking about setting up a new sequestration process to cut spending across the board to ensure any debt limit increase is met with greater spending cuts. The key is if the Joint Committee fails to achieve at least $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions.
Where are you getting that selling point
that the Republican leadership issued to their members to get them to support this budget.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they're not cuts. They're not cuts.
Well, it's
an interesting take. Al, you had a comment.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you were just
you're just totally in shock, right?
He was reaching for his glass.
The one thing that the Republicans did get in the bill that was signed today is $1 trillion in cuts to discretionary spending over the next 10 years. That's a number, but it's not a number that everybody was comfortable with. The Dems are not happy with that number because it will probably touch your old pals over at EPA. It'll probably touch education. It'll probably touch energy. That's something that not a lot of people are going to be real thrilled about on the Dems side.
There are two interesting mega issues that were not resolved. The first is exactly what you said. There are huge cuts to EPA in the Interior Environment Appropriations bill, which is on the floor in the House, and they adjourned leaving it on the floor of the House. It has not been enacted before they left. The second is the FAA reauthorization, where you're talking about real jobs, real construction projects, $30 million a day in tax revenues that the airlines are keeping. And all of those things are just left there. They're not touched. They're not resolved. Those are cans kicked down the road by any other name.
But one of the things in the bill that the Republicans did not like is the non-discretionary spending cuts that they were hoping to get. Is this the right time to start bringing up non-discretionary spending cuts?
Well, they're gone home, so they won't do anything for a while. But yes, I think we have to put as much on the table as we can get on the table when we start working on it and when they get back. They have no choice. Got to cut broadly enough to reduce the deficit. If we're only cutting just so the deficit goes up X billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, and if we don't cut any more than just to keep even with that, we're not cutting the deficit.
Well, and this whole issue, the sequestration process is designed to guarantee that Congress acts on the Joint Committee's legislation to cut spending.
Are you reading some more Republican?
Yes,
well,
yes.
This is some of the selling points in order for the Republican leadership to get their members to pass this bill. So, these are very important points.
Hold on.
Hold on.
One of the things I do want to talk about, though, is the big ticket item was tax reform and tax increases. The tax reform situation was something that got brought in. The Republicans wanted tax reform as part of this deal. They did not get that. Is that a hit, Alan, to the Republicans' ability to get this deal done?
I guess I have trouble with your premise. They weren't that anxious to get tax reform into this deal at all because they're worried every time you talk about tax reform that's a Trojan horse for tax increases. Having said that, they came pretty close, and the Gang of Six in the Senate was proposing this. The Simpson Bowles said, look, we've got hundreds of billions of dollars of tax preferences. If we phase those out, we'll increase revenues. We don't have to touch the top rate. and they didn't talk about it. The other big items are the capital gains rate and the rate on dividends, which are artificially low.
Well, they were also talking about loopholes, doing away and sunsetting a lot of the loopholes.
Well,
they didn't get that.
But these are the big loopholes that exist. The big money items for individuals are exactly this. And then there's the corporate world. We've heard from the president so many times about jet aircraft depreciation, but there's lots of things on the corporate side that we can also get rid of to enhance revenue.
John,
I won't let them take my tax deduction from my corporate plane away. No way, over my dead body. No, I think that three important things happened. I think that you began to develop a serious consensus around reforming the tax code, lowering rates, broadening the base, and closing the loopholes. And there are serious people working on that, most notably Dave Camp, who's chairman of Ways and Means. Secondly, we're going to reverse the trajectory of government spending. And thirdly, I don't remember.
Correct me if I'm wrong on process here, but it seems to me that as we now move on into the appropriations and the budget and that kind of stuff, that the Tea Party is not going to be able to back us up against a cliff in which if we fall off, we have disaster. That if they really expect Democrats to go along with restructuring of Social Security and Medicare and those kind of things, they are going to have to go along with revenue increases. They won't be able to stand there and say no and make it stick in the legislative process to come.
Well, let me ask this question, though. Did Congress miss an opportunity to truly bring the complex tax code to light, to simplify it as a part of this deal process? Al?
No. I mean, how many straws do you think you can put on that camel's back trying to, deal with the debt ceiling? Absolutely not. That is more appropriately handled down the line. It's going to be very, very difficult. Now, there's no question about that. But I think all putting that back before the debt limit debate would have only made it further complicated and harder to solve.
Ralph?
Here's the key. Many of the conservative Republicans, in order to get them to come on board, in order to have, before the debt ceiling can be raised, Congress and the president have to enact spending cuts of a larger amount first. That is a big selling point to get these people to come on board.
I think one of the things, if we're going to talk about that, the budget process since Obama took office, he implemented, even before Obama, during the Bush administration, there's been an inherent pay-go type situation in fiscal spending in Congress. There should be what Jeb Bush did in Florida. Look, you want to spend on a new program? Fine. You find a dollar. For every dollar you want to spend on a new program, you're going to have to kill another dollar in an old program. It's simple pay as you go. It's simple reciprocal spending policy. And that wasn't in play.
And well, why did we have to work so hard to get conservative fiscal Republicans on board a plan to not default on our debt? That doesn't make any sense to me. That's the wrong debate.
They're claiming President Obama has managed to, quote, increase the federal deficit by over $4.3 trillion since he was sworn into office.
Wait. Who quoted that?
Huh?
Who's that quote by?
That comes from Congressman Billy Long, one of his press releases.
That's Congressman Billy Long saying that?
One of his press releases to his constituents in Missouri.
It's arithmetic.
I'll tell you something. Yeah. I can make – I'm a Republican. No bones about it. I can tell you right now, I can make numbers say anything. Give me a set of numbers, I can make it look like I've got a revenue.
Then it's up to his constituents to call him on that if you're saying it's not correct.
I'm not saying that's not correct. What I am saying is that, there is a lot of inherent – look, TARP and the auto bailout and the bank bailout are legacy programs from the Bush administration into the Obama administration. The Obama administration inherited those. that is not something that he could have changed unless he did away with the programs. We've seen in many instances, i.e. the auto bailouts, where that was a successful program. But to sit there and say that the White House is single-handedly, look, members of Congress still were voting on budgets from back in 2009-2010 to increase the spending. The presidential budget request is just a request. They had to approve the budget bill. So when members of Congress come out and start putting out rhetoric, this is part of the problem. I think this is how we got to this space right now, is we don't have politicians that sit there and sit down and say, look, these are the facts. This is what we're spending. This is what we've got to cut. Like it, don't like it, this is what we got to do. The Republicans are just as bad as the Democrats, because the Democrats sitting there saying entitlements are off the block. Guess what? There's no reason why people like Warren Buffett should be drawing a Social Security test or a Social Security check. That means we've got to invoke means testing.
And as much as this deal is criticized, and including by me, it put defense spending and entitlements on the table. It is a step in the direction that you're talking about.
Absolutely. That I will
agree.
That I will agree with. But talking about the entitlements, Bob, when we look at the tax code and the entitlements, did the Republicans win in the matter that they were able to bring these sort of inside the beltway discussions to the general populace as a result of this deal?
Yeah.
Or as a result of this crisis?
The most important thing is it's on the table. And I think once the public begins to recognize that it is on the table and it is part of the discussion, we're going to be all the better for it, because we're going to have to deal with revenue enhancements, we're going to have to deal with entitlement changes, we're going to have to deal with cuts across the board in some places, and we're going to have to raise some revenues. And the only way to get that done is to make sure the public understands that there's an example. Everybody says we don't want to change Social Security. Okay, fine. If we don't change Social Security, anybody around this table, our kids are not going to get the same kind of a program we've got today. That's a fact. We have to change it. That doesn't mean we got to mess it up. It means we got to fix it. There's a lot of ways to fix it.
Well, then this gets back to my point. We have to talk about real reform rather than just cutting spending.
Well, Al, let me go back to what Bob was saying. And the question I gave to Bob was, did the Democrats win in the aspect of bringing some of these inside the beltway? Were the Democrats able to get their arms wrapped around the entitlement issues, the non-discretionary spending issues, make it their own and saying, look, these are things that we just cannot touch, which was a major point of this budget deal?
I think both parties stated their position, stated it vigorously, and hoped that the public would take it up and understand it. Now, most of the polls indicate that the Republicans were not terribly successful in doing that, and that the president had some success in doing that. I wouldn't think it would be very long-lasting, but essentially the bickering, and I think the reason the Republicans were losing was because they were being so intransigent. It wasn't so much that they were selling their point of view, and nor was it that the president was selling his point of view. But the Republicans were saying hell no to everything, and the president was talking about a balanced approach and what have you. Sounded like he could negotiate.
Well, let's hold off on that, because we've gone long on this segment. It's a great discussion. I want to keep this discussion. We got three other items that we got to talk about that were components of the bill that the president signed earlier. But we're going to take about a three-minute break. When we come back, we're going to finish that discussion. We're also going to talk about the subject that John wanted to bring up earlier, and that's the FAA issue, which ties into what we're talking about right now. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Everybody's got a team.
da 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 da.
And we're back here in Chili's back room, a very populated, smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics. And it's happy hour, by the way, here at Backroom Politics. The alcohol is flowing. The discussions are getting a little bit more colorful. Al's put on his summer fedora, thank God.
We've got everything here that the McLaughlin Company has, except you're saying... But the truth answer is...
Yeah. Oh, trust me, I'll invoke that puppy. I'll go. I will go John McLaughlin on everybody in about a minute. We're going to continue the discussion while we're drinking our martinis and ordering our wines and our Jack Daniels. By the way, we'll take Jack Daniels as a sponsor down the road. Let's talk about the budget deal that the president signed into law today. For those of you who have been... you know, getting your news feeds from Rangoon. If you're just joining us, basically the president has signed into law a bill that will avert fiscal crisis. It'll allow the debt ceiling to be raised and also put into place several spending cut measures, and it creates what we're now calling the Dirty Dozen, which will include a Magnificent Seven, hopefully at one time. But it is going to be interesting. The super committee is a new term floating around the Beltway right now. And we'll get to that in a second. But let's go back to the rest of the issues. We've talked about tax reform. When you talk about this deal, the one thing that they're talking about is the enforcement mechanisms to ensure proper fiscal responsibility in government. The committee is going to be responsible for at least $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction. It's automatic across-the-board cuts of $1.2 trillion that will be enacted by changes in agency spending, changes in discretionary spending that's appropriated by budget bills in the future. One of the enforcement mechanisms, I should say, that was on the table that the Democrats had put up were automatic cuts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid were shielded. The Democrats won that one. Is that a big win, John, for the Dems?
It's a huge win. But the key is automatic. I think that we are going to have – I like concept of reform better than cuts, but we are going to have to change Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, reduce defense spending – and close the loopholes. And sooner or later, we're going to do all of that. I don't know what the next deadline is. I've just assumed, follow my good friend Alan Moore, and arbitrarily say that by December 13th, we have to do it. December 13th is the drop-dead date, you know, because we need that kind of a deadline. But, yes, they won, and they shielded that. They also, by the way, shielded the food program for women. It's called WIC, Women,
right.
Infant, and Children. Which is very important.
That's a third rail. I mean, that's a third rail. You're talking about abortion spending, arguably.
No, I'm talking about feeding programs.
Oh, feeding
programs.
I'm sorry, wrong program. You're right. One of the things, though, that they did not get was tax increases. There is an inherent talk in this town, and nobody on the Hill wants to talk about it. Nobody over at 1600 Pennsylvania wants to talk about it. It is the fact that you can do all the deficit talk you want, and we're just now trying to pay for bills that we've already done. What we're not talking about is how we're going to reduce the deficit and how we're going to get back to a surplus. The only way to do that is to find new sources of revenue incoming to the government coffers. Bob?
One of the things that is not generally talked about is that the David Camp, who's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and some of his committee people over there, the staffs and the members are talking, they have been talking for the better part of 6 months. And they're talking about how they're going to change the tax code. Now, I would expect that at some point, probably after Congress gets back this fall, we are going to see a package of materials that will be coming from the Ways and Means Committee, which could probably be the foundation of some serious changes in the tax code, and it will raise some revenues, probably without raising tax rates. There's all kinds of things you can do. It's just a matter of being willing to do it, and I think the Ways and Means Committee will probably put something out that will be very worthwhile to look at.
Now, we talked about Jack Lew before, but the one topic that Jack Lew has been, I haven't seen him be adamant about the idea of increasing revenue streams into the fiscal coffers here in the United States government. I would think that would be something he would be pushing adamantly.
Not his role.
As OMB, you don't think?
No.
He's got to create the budget.
It's his role to do it behind the scenes. What does he stand for that you've heard? You know, this is a guy who has to look at everything. He's got to look at revenues and spending, know a lot of detail, which he does, provide ideas, options, and so on. OMB
has put out white papers before, you know, going back to the Carter administration, where OMB has put out white papers saying, look, in order for us to be sustainable in our current spending programs, we're going to have to find new ways. That is the role of OMB, at least in my opinion.
But you're saying there's Jack Lew and there's OMB. You know, and you're making it as though he should become a personal, outspoken guy. That's where Treasury really does come in. They've got the IRS. But they want revenue. Lew wants revenue. The president wants revenue. The Democrats want revenue. A lot of Republicans want some revenue. And if the president really wants revenue, he has got $2.7 trillion at his fingertips if he's elected at the end of December of next year. He can let all the Bush-era tax cuts expire, all of them. He only wants to keep 20% of them. But if he lets them all expire, that's $2.7 trillion over 10 years. All he has to do is sustain that against the Congress.
But Al,
that's a lot of revenue.
Yeah, but Al, when we look at members of Congress, nobody, Democratic or Republican, wants to go back and saying, look, the government's taking more money out of your pocket. Can Democrats, even as a minority, can they sell a possible revenue increase, whether you want to call it increased taxes, whether you want to call it closing out loopholes? Can they successfully sell their constituents on revenue increases into the government?
Well, you're talking about a party that has been having trouble selling the coming of the dawn. I don't know what's wrong with the message process of the Democratic Party, but it's been lousy for many, many years. The answer is yes, that can be sold. I'm not sure whether these guys know how to sell it. Clearly, the idea that you use tax expenditures, that you close loopholes, that you don't give big oil or the subsidies that it's got, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that ought to be easy to sell the public.
Ralph,
hasn't been so far.
Ralph, one of the things that we talked about on the show previously was to encourage people to repatriate their money back into the U.S., you provide a low tax rate at 5%. Which is what George Bush did back in 2005. Now, once they have the money back in the U.S., then the money can be invested in job creation programs, which is what John had recommended.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, when we talk about job creation programs, today in the Rose Garden at the White House, after he signed the bill, President Obama came out and said, okay, this is done, this is water under the bridge, jobs. Bob, you made a point earlier saying you're predicting that a year from now, even with this deal in place, we'll still be at 9-point-something unemployment.
I think so.
How come?
Because, number one, anything that we're able to put in place in the, let's say, in the, by the end of this year is barely going to be able to be effective next year, given the regular way the government works. It's slow to get things going. I don't see how, unless we do something very dramatic, that we're going to be able to cut the unemployment rate very much.
Al,
the economy
is
moving slowly. It's just not moving.
Al, do you agree with that?
I think unless something remarkably changes from the directions we're going, it's going to be very difficult to...
John?
I think it's the biggest conundrum that we have. You know, the corporations have recovered, profits are up, spending is up, but jobs are stuck. I think it's a condition of the restructuring of the economy, and it's going to take a lot of smart, dedicated people working for a long time. Can I go back for a quick second to what you started with? We keep saying the right fight. The right fight is revenue and spending. If we're going to raise revenue, what are we going to spend it on? If you put the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Hal Rogers, and Dave Camp, Republicans both, conservatives both, in a room and said, you got to come up with a balance of revenues, taxes, and spending, they could do it. And most of us around this table, regardless of our party, would agree. You can't talk about one without the other. They're joined at the hip. They're the Siamese twins of this problem.
I agree, but here's the problem, though. We have now put three different discussions into one large mega discussion, that being the debt ceiling. And it's going to be hard for the American population, the American electorate, to separate those three discussions out. The three discussions being revenue increases, spending cuts, and a debt ceiling increase. Those are three distinct individual discussions
the debt ceiling doesn't belong in that discussion.
I agree, Alan.
And the debt ceiling is basically moved to the side now.
Right.
And we come back to the real hard decisions. The super committee by Thanksgiving. But we've got all these appropriations bills that are going through the process now. Those are real decisions, real money this year. Most of the savings in this package, remember, are down the road. The debt ceiling just goes away. We continue to borrow until it comes creeping back at us sometime a year and a half from now after the next election. So we're back to the hard work of figuring out what to spend, how much this year's deficit, how much next year's deficit should be. We're back to normal.
Ralph.
The ironic thing is we're now talking about a recession that's caused by government, not by the private sector. That's a real interesting
How so?
Because in the private sector, the corporations' profits are up, but government has been trying to fix the problem to encourage businesses to hire more people.
Wow, Ralph, I got to tell you something. I didn't think there was anybody in the history of the world that could get me to be a Democrat other than you. I am sounding more and more of a Democrat on a lot of what you're talking about.
The pundits are saying this. The ironic thing is that it's...
Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, look, I mean, the reality is why their profits up because they've got tax loopholes. They're not paying their fair share. I've got to say that this is something that, you know, the government did not create the recession. I would say that Wall Street created the recession, and I'm a huge fan of Wall Street. I'm a huge fan of the free market economy. But what I will say is that yes, is there an inherent culpability by government in this? Absolutely. But I'm talking right now at this second. Wall Street in junk loans, in quick money stock trades,
credit default swaps,
all of that. That's Wall Street. That's not Treasury.
Mortgage underpinning.
Yeah. Absolutely. But one of the questions I did have, and I'm going to pose this to Al, is, you know, we talked about jobs creation bill. The president comes out today and says it's all about jobs. What jobs creation bill can the government implement without getting sideways on the debt ceiling? Can they do it, or is this political rhetoric?
Well,
skip the debt ceiling, but without increasing spending. Seems to me that there's a problem we've had in this country for a long time, and that is our infrastructure, which was built during Dwight Eisenhower, and it's gotten old. Something Bob and I understand. You know, it gets a little.
You guys aren't old. You guys are just aging.
We're not in this country.
And we have for a long time. Been told that we really need to pay attention to our bridges, our highways, and some new methods of transportation that may be effective, and railroads and so forth. And those are the kinds of government-sponsored projects that create tons and tons of jobs. So I would suggest that we do that. Now, one of the reasons that it has not been done is that the public works committees of both houses have made such a pork barrel out of that appropriation all these years that people think that's money down a rat hole. I think we need to come up with a program where we will prioritize what needs to be done on the basis of some engineering studies and so forth.
Needs testing. Yeah.
And the president puts it. He will veto anything that doesn't fit with that list of priorities, and get to work on the bridges that are falling down and the highways that need to be done and some new initiatives in terms of.
Yeah, John.
And yet we have major cuts already in water and wastewater funding. And we have major cuts in airport construction. We have a feud over highways that is going to be exacerbated by the feud over the airports. And infrastructure investment and education investment needs to go in the spot that the debt ceiling vacates. Taxes, revenue, investment.
The government is trying to fix all these problems and it's failing miserably. They tried a stimulus that failed. Now they want to pour more money down a drain.
Hold on.
Government is culpable.
The question I have for you, though, John, is how many airports do we really need? We saw infrastructure programs like the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska. We saw infrastructure programs like the airport in Southern Illinois that literally gets one commercial flight a day.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I think the public has no confidence that public works money does anything but build a bridge to nowhere that gets named after some congressman. What I'm saying is that in order to sell that to the American public and accomplish what we want, we need some kind of a prioritization with an enforcement that would come through presidential means.
On a national basis.
Bob.
It seems to me to remind ourselves that when we had this $870 billion stimulus package, there was a whole lot of talk about shovel-ready projects. I think we would all agree there weren't very many shovel-ready projects, and it went most of the money. Well, a lot of the money went to the state governments, to take care of their pensions and things like that. We do need exactly what Al says. We need one other thing. And I know this is not something that is easy for the Democrats to talk about, but one of the problems we've got is when the federal government is building projects, Davis-Bacon talks about probably a 20% increase in the cost of every project because of the Davis-Bacon laws. Most of the construction industry... Davis-Bacon basically says that you have to have union workers on federal building
prevailing wages.
Yeah,
it's not just anywhere. Like in North Dakota, you have to pay the same wages that you pay in New York if it involves federal money.
Exactly.
Right.
And what we need to do is say we waive that for this period of time when we're trying to get every dollar we can spent on fixing all the highways and all the bridges. We get 20%, probably more, if we let Davis Bacon be suspended for a couple of years.
Bob, that, is somebody who's always willing to support Davis Bacon.
Well, Davis Bacon.
I agree.
Yeah, I think something, but it has to also be the kind of a project thing you're talking about. It's got to be. It can't be what the senator or the congressman wants in his backyard. It's got to be looked at by the federal government agency objectively and say, get it done.
But
I think a law that says that no federal project can be named after a member of Congress.
So the thought,
Danny or Mark.
Let's say have a horrible death.
Right.
Or that's just Al Swift Highway.
Yes. Yeah. The Al Swift Memorial Bridge is
How
now
about
gone.
The bridge to nowhere for Al Swift?
Yeah. but let me go back.
I've already got a high speed rail law named
that's true.
I've taken care
of. That's true. But I want to go back to Davis Bacon, because again, as a Republican, I can't believe I'm saying this. The trick is, if you're going to create jobs and you've got to build infrastructure, okay, it's going to take local labor to make that happen. You cannot tell me that somebody who is going to make $10 an hour doing, you know, complex welding on a bridge is going to stay in North Dakota when he can go to New Jersey and make $25 an hour. Davis Bacon, I think, is appropriate. Now then, the key word here, though, is means testing. Means testing. If you were to means test, I think what we are talking about is the term I think you brought up, John, was an equitable working wage for Davis Bacon. Is Davis Bacon the right tool for that? I would say no. I would say that we could reform Davis Bacon and create a prevailing wage scale that is equitable without having direct government enforcement.
I can't believe I'm hearing this. But to just prove your point, does anybody have any idea who Davis or Bacon were? I mean, it is old. It needs reform. But by the same token,
the company that did ham.
The guy.
You know, the fact of the matter
is, the guy is probably not going to migrate for the job. People are underwater on their mortgages.
Yeah.
They can't go to where the jobs are. That's part of the problem. So we need, for a while, in some way, to take the jobs to where the people are that are unemployed, because they can't leave. They're stuck.
But how can you justify building a bridge that will sustain beltway-type traffic to create jobs in Wyoming where there's not a need?
No, that's not what he's saying. The first prerequisite is to decide objectively where the needs are and what the need is for. Not to overbuild, but to appropriately build. Then create a system where that's where your money goes, and you want to get the most bang for the buck. So you don't have these artificial rules that inflate the cost.
Well, now let me throw something anti what I just said. As my family coming from New York State, from the metropolitan New York City area, the Tappan Zee Bridge, a vital artery into New and out of upstate New York for people who work in New York City. The Tappan Zee Bridge is now hit its lifespan. They're now talking about having to build a new Tappan Zee Bridge. Price tag right now, $9 billion to rebuild the Tappan Zee Bridge. That's insane. That is insane, considering the fact that the original Tappan Zee Bridge, even with scales of economy taken into effect, didn't even cost $800 million in today's dollars. So what do we do with that? I mean, that's got to be, I mean, that's environmental regulations, that's OSHA regulations. Now we get into a whole new subject of, if we're going to talk about jobs creation, we're going to have to talk about regulatory reform.
Well, you're the Republican who supports Davis Bacon. I'm the Democrat who supports making sense out of and rationing a lot of our environmental laws.
Including
they're layered, especially EPA. They're layered one on top of the other. It's not EPA's fault. It's Congress's fault. We need to sort it out. They're layered one on top of the other. When a new one comes in, it doesn't reconcile with the previous one. And I bet you, of your $9 billion, I'll bet you anything, $2 billion is environmental regulation.
I would agree. Right.
Cut bureaucracy, red tape, and streamline government, and start getting money directly into infrastructure projects like the Chinese have done so effectively.
And the only way to do it rapidly is to suspend, you know, to in effect do find some way to suspend some of the rules and focus on getting the work done. And there's all kinds of things we need to get done.
Al, you had a comment.
The roads are terrible. Look, all you got to do is drive.
Here's an idea, and there are people who know a hell of a lot more about this than I do, and they need to put on their thinking caps and come up with proposals. But if, in fact, you're expecting somebody in North Dakota to pay New York wages, what I think the labor people, they won't want to give that up, but what they're really after is wanting some assurance that they don't get chopped down to nothing. Could you not come up with some system such as it must be paid a wage that is proportionally relevant to the area that they're in?
That's what I was just saying.
Precisely.
Yeah, if they're being paid X percent above the average in New York, they get paid X percent above the average in North Dakota. And that,
no question.
Yeah, that protects them from contractors screwing them. And it gets the job done.
Well, I'll tell you, again, this will probably, the infrastructure question is a huge debate. We'll probably bring that up, Alan.
One other piece on infrastructure and public works is where the materials come from. And there's always going to be a temptation, especially in this environment, to say, well, we got to buy America. And if you go buy America, you run directly contrary to this getting the massive bang for your buck. There's a bridge, a new opened San Francisco bridge being built, new span. All the steel is coming from China. Hundreds of millions of dollars of steel coming from China. And it's less than half what it would cost in America.
Well, it's because America's not a manufacturing community anymore.
But if you're trying to create jobs,
yeah,
the whole idea of Buy America is you're preserving or creating jobs.
Right.
Actually, what you want to do is spend some money to create some of those jobs, to build things.
Hold on. The reality is, Al, your point is, you know, you got to create, you got to buy American, but on high-speed rail, the irony is, your high-speed rail projects, they say they create American jobs. A majority of the contractors running high-speed rail are European.
But
you're talking about Siemens. You're talking about the Italians.
They will be all, because there is no industry for that in this country now. But you said something there that didn't work, and I lost it.
High-speed rail?
High-speed rail. And they're not bringing in foreign workers.
The people that are building the trains are European.
But they're not building the tracks.
Building the tracks is the big deal.
But building the trains are also creating jobs. You need engineers to design them. Where does the steel come from? I mean, look, I can tell you right now, there are people in Pittsburgh, there are people in, Bob, your old portions of Ohio, that would kill to have steel mills fired up again.
Sure they are.
But we can't, because we're held hostage by, and going again against what I just said, because this is what I can do as moderator, I have that privilege.
How come we don't?
Because I'm the moderator, darn it. But going back to what you're saying is, we want to create jobs. The reality is Chinese steel is cheap. Why? Because the Chinese government owns half the steel mills in China. It's all government subsidized. You know, if you want to come up with an appropriate program like the shipbuilding program, Title 11, which guarantees the loans to build the ships, if you want to come up with a steel loan guarantee program like that, that will help get American steel competitive again, absolutely, I'm all in favor of that.
What I said was, there are people who know much better than I do how to do this. I just threw out an idea I had. It seems to me that you get the right people with the right expertise and the right, differences of opinion and what have you, to sit down and try and figure this out.
But the kernel to grow is loan guarantees, not subsidies.
Correct. Correct. That I will agree with.
That
I will agree with. Wow, it is hard to believe, but we have covered this show in its entirety. We have 10 minutes left in the show. We're not even going to go to break. We're going to go right into our free form. It's happy hour, and that means it's time for our favorite portion, Tell Me a Story. This is the part of the show where we go around the table and we ask for news scoops, rumor, conjecture, anything that we can scoop any of the major media outlets, like we did with the Norm, with the Leon Panetta and General Petraeus news story. So we're going to go around the table. I'm going to start with Bob. Bob, tell me a story.
I'm not going to tell you a story. I'm going to make a suggestion that I think would be very useful to some people. We're talking about the super committee. Six senators, 3 and 3 party. Six House members, 3 and 3 each party. Who's going to be on that committee? Now, I'm going to suggest just one name of one person I think should be on that committee.
Who's that?
I think that one of the finest senators we could possibly put on, if you are a Republican, is someone who really understands budgeting, yep, really understands how to do things. Rob Portman should be a member of that committee, and I hope that the leader will think, and I think he has high regard for the senator from Ohio, and I think Rob Portman would be an excellent member of that committee.
I'll see your Portman and raise you Mark Warner.
I'll see your Mark Warner, and I'll see the good senator from Ohio, and I'll raise you Tom Coburn.
That would be.
I think Coburn, who I admire greatly, is probably better not on that committee.
I think he'd be
better on the outside, keeping him honest. I disagree respectfully.
I think he's a good pick because he's got the relationship with Obama on the R side that other Republicans just don't have, and that is what we need.
And he's got credibility.
What about credibility?
What about Ray LaHood?
Ray LaHood.
If he left the Obama administration and went
on. If he leaves the Obama, he's definitely not going back to Capitol Hill. I'll tell you that right
he's
now.
He's too damn smart.
Yeah.
He would be excellent, but
he
understands. He's better than anybody. Kent Conrad.
Kent Conrad, an interesting pick.
He'd be an excellent
lame duck. That's good.
That's true. He can make some key decisions.
He's not running. That's good.
No, but he's also on Simpson Bowles. He's also on the Gang of Six.
Yeah. He knows this stuff.
Perfect. He knows where the bodies are buried. Yeah. Exactly. Good point. Alan, tell me a story.
Yeah. One of the most amazing moments that I've seen in Congress for a long time was Gabby Giffords coming to the floor.
Absolutely. We forgot to mention.
10 minutes standing ovation for her. John Boehner wasn't the only one crying. Everybody was crying.
I will agree.
Really moving.
I will tell you right now.
Wasn't that wonderful?
That was fabulous.
I got to tell you something. You know what? I wrote this on Facebook the other day, or yesterday, in fact, when I saw that. Gabrielle Giffords, the congresswoman from Tucson, Arizona, has more strength, more fight, more gumption, more determination than 99% of the people currently sitting up on Capitol Hill. She embodies the greatness of what we're looking for in this country, and she embodies the greatness in what we're looking for in leaders. She is absolutely an amazing story, and I'll tell you something. I hope she gets back to 100%. I hope she comes back and kicks some butt in this town, because she's exactly what we're looking for.
We'll be happy with her at about 80%.
I agree.
They were just mentioning about her running for re-election.
Yeah, I have a feeling she'll be running for re-election, and you know what? I'll hold signs for her.
She may be running for senator.
You know what? I'll hold signs for her there, too.
But I hope
not. I think it'll be a little bit much. John, tell me a story.
Yeah, I think that the two winners in this whole process were two quiet people. I couldn't agree more about Jack Lew. And the other person who doesn't hog the limelight, who I would give a lot of credit to, is Kevin McCarthy from California, who's the number three in the leadership, who took the seat from one of the most argumentative, brilliant, outspoken men I've ever worked with, and I knew Bill Thomas. He took Bill Thomas, a congressman who was chairman of Ways and Means. He took his seat from the Central Valley of California, Bakersfield. And Kevin McCarthy is a gem. And he crosses the aisle. He gets along with people. And he's a leader. And Eric Cantor was out there making all the noise. Kevin McCarthy was working his butt off to make this happen.
This is a Democrat praising a Republican. How bipartisan can you get?
Hey, this show has been completely strange. I was supporting Davis Bacon at one time. Al, tell me a story.
My story is that we have solved so many problems. We have solved so many problems here today that we should send a transcript to the Congress.
Interesting. Ralph, tell me a story.
Newt Gingrich is $1 million in debt. He's currently launching a debt retirement campaign that will extend through Iowa.
And go all the way to Tiffany's.
Civility. Civility, sir. Civility, sir. Civility. Civility.
In fact, I heard that Tiffany's is opening in a branch in Des Moines.
Oh, civility. Wow. Civility, sir.
So watch for this. It shows he'll be out of the race.
I'm not so much a story, but I'll tell you the winners in this. Joe Biden has solidified his place in the history books, in my opinion, as a result of this deal. I think Speaker Boehner proved that, you know, he can compromise with the best of them, but I think he's got a harder hammer than he's letting out to be. I think he's a very effective speaker. I think the two winners of this are Biden and Boehner, in my opinion.
Very good men.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question. I want to thank everybody for listening. Unfortunately, I didn't give out the number as much as I should. I probably should have given it out more, but the discussion here was just too awesome.
You're becoming senile.
I am becoming senile. I want to thank all the people that were here in the Peanut Gallery listening to us.
What's wrong with that? Bob and I have been senile for years.
And yet you still
speak
come on
for
the
yourself,
show.
Whatever your name is.
He didn't know you were a Democrat.
Alan, love to have you come back and join
thank
us. We,
you.
We'd love to have you here every week. We really appreciate your insight. But on behalf of the usual gang...
But he still can't go to his left.
He still can't go to his left. Yeah, exactly.
We used to play basketball together.
Against each other.
Really?
For
really?
A long time.
Did you work him harder under the boards?
We worked each other. We were a good match.
Yeah, but you had a few pounds on me.
I didn't. I had less then.
I got.
We were a good matchup.
I got.
Gave and got.
You have lost control.
No. Actually, it brings up a very quick story about a friend of ours, Rick Larson, represents 2nd Congressional District, Washington State. Rick Larson was in here joining us, having a discussion once. And as we were talking, he's an avid basketball player and is very physical in his basketball playing. I introduced him to a friend of mine from Honolulu, Hawaii. He's a Marine out at the Marine Barracks in Hano. And he had mentioned he was going out to Hano, and he says that we're going to have a basketball game. You're welcome to join in. He says, you know what? I'd love to join in. So Congressman Larson gets in to the game, pickup game over there at Marine Barracks. And apparently, according to my Marine sources, he's not afraid to throw an elbow or two. So I got to give Rick Larson credit. He's another basketball player. You know what I think we should do is get a backroom politics pickup game.
No mas.
No mas. No mas.
On a serious note.
We got a new need.
We don't want another
leg. Hold on. Okay, hold on.
I got one leg.
Ralph. Hold on, Ralph.
On a serious note, before we depart, shocking brutality coming out of Syria, bodies being tossed around like trash. Our hearts go out to the people that are voicing opposition to the regime.
We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
But on behalf of Alan, again, we'd love to have you back. On behalf of Al Swift, John Freshman, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, thank you to our cigar supplier, Frank the Bodyguard, and Veritas Cigars.
I have a name for the day for the pickup game. Jared's all day.
Wow. Frank, thanks. Stick to the smokes, dude. On behalf of Backroom Politics, thanks for joining us today. We'll be back here next Tuesday live from Shelley's Back Room. You were pointing at... I said Bob Hines.
No, Shelley's Back Room. The place
wait. We'll be back here next... Let me... Who's moderating this thing?
Come on. I'm there.
Yeah. So on behalf of the Backroom Politics, join us next week live on Blog Talk Radio, where we'll be here at 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Shelley's Back Room. Bob?
The place to be.
There it is, kids. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.